Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Then There Were Two, a History of the World series. I'm Jeffrey Clark, being joined virtually by Lucas Mitzel. Lucas, we start a new decade this week, and we're off to a pretty interesting start. We have one team that has won the World Series before, but has been at sea for over half a century and not won since being in that city. And we got a team that literally has never gone. So talk about some players who really feel like they owe it to their fan bases to finally win something.
Yeah, heck of a start to the 2010s, which, first of all, I can hardly believe that we are that far into this course of this podcast. We are almost caught up to present day, but we have an absolutely phenomenal one of a team that has won a few titles and has a nice, rich history and tradition. But like you said, they have not won a title in their current city, even though they have made appearances in the Fall Classic.
Well, let's go over this San Francisco Giants team, shall we? It begins and ends with their pitching staff. Most notably, at this point, the two-time defending National League Cy Young Award winner, Tim Lincecum. And he picks up right where he left off at the beginning of the season. He wins his first five decisions, including his first four starts. And Lincecum does kind of have an up-and-down season. In August, he falters a bit. He goes 0-5 and has a 7.82 ERA. And the Giants go 13-15 that month. But he does not have to do this by himself. He is supported by some guys who will become household names in San Francisco sooner or later. Matt Cain, who was the 25th overall pick in 2002. Lincecum, by the way, was the 10th overall pick in 2006. And then you have Brian Wilson, their closer, who was drafted in the 24th round 2003. Jonathan Sanchez, 27th round 2004. Oh, and some guy by the name of Madison Bumgarner, who was the 10th overall pick in 2007. Although Bumgarner begins the season in AAA. And when he does join the rotation, he fits right in. In fact, he joins Sanchez and Lincecum as having sub-2 ERAs in September. Sanchez 1.01, Bumgarner 1.13, and Lincecum 1.94. And beginning September 5th, the Giants do not allow more than 3 runs in 18 consecutive games. That is the longest such streak since 1917. And they also get some support from guys who were not with the team to begin the season. Pat Burrow, whom we've talked about before on the podcast, signed with them on May 29th, 10 days after the Rays granted him free agency. And that same day, they call up a catcher by the name of Buster Posey from AAA. And then you have Cody Ross claimed off waivers from the Marlins on August 22nd. And still, the Giants need to go to the final day of the season to win the National League West. 5 shutout innings by Sanchez and a save by Wilson clinched that. The Giants end up having the best ERA in the major leagues at 3.36. And it should come as no surprise that for the first time in 8 years, they are back in the World Series.
Yeah, no, they managed to make a run. They knocked out the Cincinnati Reds in the division series without too much of a fuss and did end up needing 6 games to knock off the 2-time defending National League champion Philadelphia Phillies, but managed to do so with a 3-2 victory in Game 6 in Philadelphia to punch their ticket back to the Fall Classic. And like you said at the outset, this starts and ends with that solid rotation. I mean, there's a lot of youth in this, but it's a lot of youth with a lot of potential for this group. Skipping ahead briefly to the future, I would get to see Tim Lincecum pitch the following summer after this World Series in a game at Wrigley Field, where he and Ryan Dempster, of all people, ended up matching zeros for a significant chunk of the game. And the thing I remember most with Lincecum was on that particular June evening at Wrigley, where I was watching out from the left field bleachers, he was having a little bit of trouble commanding his fastball that night, and yet pretty much every time the count went 2-0-3-1, he would just drop a curveball in for a strike and managed to work himself out of it. This is why the man has won multiple Cy Youngs.
Let me just talk about these pitchers being drafted in comparison to a team we have not talked about on the podcast for quite some time. The Pittsburgh Pirates have not gone back to the World Series since the We Are Family iteration won the whole thing in 1979. All of those guys that I mentioned, Cain, Lincecum, Bumgarner, were on the board when the Pirates were drafting. The guys that they chose instead had a combined big league record of 2-13 at the end of the 2010 season. You might remember some of these guys, Lucas. Brian Bullington, Brad Lincoln, and Daniel Moskos.
I think I maybe recognize one of those names off the top of my head, which, I mean, I hate to be dunking on the Pirates here, but it's kind of justified at this point in time, honestly.
We've talked enough about the pitching side. The offense has been a very interesting case. The team ranked 17th in the majors in runs scored, but they were second in preventing them. The offense was maybe a lot of cast-offs. My two favorites are Aaron Rowand and Juan Uribe, both members of the 2005 White Sox. There was nobody who hits 30 home runs or drove in 90 runs, and this is a team that had Barry Bonds only a few years back. Aubrey Huff signed as a free agent in January because he got no other offers. We already mentioned Burl and Ross being released by other teams. So, again, you have a team that was kind of similar, I would say, to those 2005 White Sox, a team full of cast-offs, and still they were able to get to the World Series.
Yeah, I mean, at least on the position player side here, you know, they talked a lot about just how much of a struggle this Giants offense had for significant chunks of the season, where, you know, the pitching staff was going along great, and we mentioned all of those names, but it doesn't mean a whole lot if you can't score runs. And there were finally stretches as the summer went on where they were able to score a few more runs and be able to support that pitching staff. And ultimately, they get things going at just the right time, and here they are back in the World Series.
Let's switch over to the American League. We have not talked about this franchise yet. The Texas Rangers, who have the best batting average in the major leagues at 276 and the most hits, 1,556. Their 3.93 ERA tied for third in the AL. That is their best rank since leading the AL in 1983. This is also the first time they have finished in the top four in ERA and runs scored 787. And their 288 home batting average is the best in the American League. Josh Hamilton wins the batting title with a 359. He also leads the AL in slugging percentage, 633, and OPS, 1,044. Vladimir Guerrero has a 300 batting average for the 10th time in his career, despite being on the back end of his career. And their pitching is pretty good, too. Cliff Lee, whom we talked about pitching for the Phillies last year, was traded to the Rangers during the offseason. He leads the AL with 0.8 walks per 9 innings, FIP 2.58, and WHIP 1.003. CJ Wilson goes 15-8 and 33 starts during his first season as a starter. They also have, coincidentally, a player that they got from the Giants on July 1st, Benji Molina. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. They also have a closer who sets the rookie record for saves 40, Neftali Feliz. So you have some decent hitting and some good pitching as well, which is surprising considering the environments that they pitch in. They are able to finally use that offense to their advantage and win their first American League pennant. Remember, this team started out as the second iteration of the Washington Senators after the first iteration moved to Minnesota and became the Twins. And up until this point, their history has been filled with near misses. I mean, yeah, you have Nolan Ryan, who was more on the back end of his career, throwing a couple of no-hitters for them. But up until this point, probably the things they're best known for were Ryan beating the crap out of Robin Ventura and a home run ball going off of Jose Canseco's head before it went out. So this is a franchise that has needed some good luck in the worst way, and finally things are looking up for them.
And I think maybe the other thing you could maybe throw the Rangers being known for was throwing out a then-record 10-year, $252 million contract to Alex Rodriguez before he would go on to eventually join the Yankees and win a World Series with them in our previous episode. So obviously he's long gone here. But there are a lot of good other pieces on this team. Ian Kinsler hitting .286 for this group. A relatively young, comparatively speaking, Nelson Cruz hitting .318 with 22 home runs. You mentioned Vlad Guerrero. He homered 29 times, drove in a team-high 115. I mean, there's just a ton of phenomenal pieces on this Ranger team, and they, at least on paper, should be giving the Giants a nice run for their money.
Well, they should, but the flip side is the Giants have a very young rotation. Nobody in their rotation is older than 27. No other team has had a feat like that ever since the draft came about in 1965. The last time you saw a lot of homegrown starters in a World Series that young on one team, you have to go back to the 56 Yankees with Whitey Ford and Don Larson and Tom Sturtevant and Bob Turley and Johnny Cooks. So we're going to see some historically young pitching on this team. And we will see how that fares starting in Game 1. We did mention earlier the trade that the Giants pulled off, trading Benji Molina to the Rangers. And there is a sign before Game 1 that we see on the World Series film saying, "Don't worry, Benji, we'll still give you a ring." And that is obviously a reference to anybody who spent even one day on the Major League roster for a World Series season gets a ring. Benji Molina already has a ring with the Angels from 2002, but it's just crazy how sometimes players get in a situation where they're going to get a ring regardless.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a nice situation for Molina to be in, and, you know, a nice kind of greeting back with his former teammates prior to the start of Game 1. But as we get into it, we have a phenomenal pitcher's duel on tap between Lincecum and Cliff Lee.
That's right. Lincecum had a 1.93 ERA in the playoffs coming in. Lee had a 0.75 ERA and won all three starts before this series. He has a 7-0 career playoff record, and we saw him do very well the previous year when he was with the Phillies. And Lee is able to get some early support. Ellis Andrews singles to lead the game off. He moves to second on a young walk. He reaches third on a Hamilton groundout to first. And then he scores when Guerrero hits a ball right back at Lincecum. It goes into shallow right. So some bad luck for the Giants right there. Cruz hit a ball back to Lincecum and chased Young back to third. But he never made the play. So the bases are loaded for Kinsler. We kind of saw a similar play in the 1986 World Series where the Red Sox were chasing the Mets on the base paths but didn't get anybody out. But unlike that time, the Rangers do not make the Giants pay because Kinsler hits into a 5-3 double play. And with one out in the first inning, Freddy Sanchez doubles, but he is doubled up when he goes too far off of second on a Posey pop-outs to second. So nothing doing for the Giants in that half of the inning. Then Molina singles to Lee off the second. He later reaches third on a Cliff Lee double.
Hitting pitchers forever.
And he scores on an Elvis Andrews sack fly. Tim Lincecum, to his credits, recovers in the third inning. He pitches a perfect inning, only throws 8 pitches, gets the heart of the Rangers lineup, no less. And then the Giants get into business. Edgar Renteria reaches on a Michael Young error at third to lead off the third. Yes, our old friend Edgar Renteria, who was with the 97 Marlins as well as the 04 Cardinals, but is better known with the Marlins at this point. He goes to second when Andres Torres is hit by a pitch, and he scores on a Sanchez RBI double. Torres then scores on a Posey RBI single to tie the game. And then the fifth inning, Torres and Sanchez have back-to-back doubles with one out. Sanchez becomes the first player to double in each of his first three series at-bats. Then Pat Burrell walks. Ross and Huff then have back-to-back RBI singles. Darren O'Day enters for Cliff Lee, who throws 104 pitches over 4 2/3 innings. And then Juan Uribe, one of my favorite guys on this team, promptly hits a 3-run home run to left center. The Giants end up sending 11 men to the plate in that fifth inning. They score 6 runs on 5 hits and 1 error. They last scored 6 runs at a World Series inning in the second inning of Game 4 of the 1937 series. The Giants win this game 11-7. Also, Lincecum allows 4 runs over 5 2/3 innings, so that pitcher's duel that was hyped up to be at the start of the game turned out not to be. And my biggest memory of this was I was interning at WGN-TV at that time, and I was there on the night of this game, and part of my responsibility was to log this game for highlights for the 9 o'clock news sportscast, and I was only too happy to log that Juan Uribe home run and it appear in that night's newscast.
Good on you. It's always nice to kind of see an old friend come back and do that. The Giants end up tacking on some insurance in the bottom of the eighth. RBI double by Travis Ishikawa, followed by RBI singles from Freddy Sanchez and future Cub Nate Shearholz. The Rangers would get a few runs back in the top half of the ninth as the Giants needed 3 pitchers to manage to work their way to the end of the game. Brian Wilson has to come in, gives up a sacrifice fly and a 2-run double. You know, obviously those runs not charged to him, but he is ultimately able to get Ian Kinsler to fly out for the final out of the game, and the Giants are on the board first in the series.
We go to Game 2. We get the pitcher's duel that we were supposed to get in Game 1, this one between Matt Cain and CJ Wilson. The game is kept scoreless through 4 innings. And then Ian Kinsler appears to hit a home run to center to lead off the fifth inning, but the ball bounces off the top of the wall, so he has to settle for a double, and the Rangers are not able to get him off second base. And then Edgar Renteria hits a solo home run to left with one out in the bottom half of that inning. The Rangers get back at it, though. Young and Hamilton have back-to-back singles with one out in the sixth. The runners move up on a wild pitch, but Cruz pops out in foul territory, and Kinsler flies out to end the inning. So, instead, it looks like they are getting back in business, but in reality, they are not. Cody Ross walks to lead off the seventh inning, then CJ Wilson develops a blister that forces him to lead after six-plus innings. Pretty good outing for him. He only gives up two runs on three hits and two walks. Darren Alvord relieves him. Ross moves to second on a huff ground out to first, and he scores on a Uribe RBI single. Matt Kane comes out after throwing 7 2/3 shutout innings. That brings his playoff total to 21 and a third shutout innings over three starts. And let me just say how cool, calm, and collected Matt Kane was in this situation. As he was coming out of the game, 43,622 at AT&T Park obviously are giving him a standing ovation. He doesn't even bother to tip his cap. As he explained, just by way, I don't know, I felt like my job wasn't all the way done. There was still a guy on, the game wasn't over. It's just me. I don't want to create any riffraff with the other team. But it really does not matter because the bottom of the eighth happens and everybody more or less forgets about Matt Kane, at least momentarily because of this. O'Day strikes out the first two batters of the eighth inning and then he gives up a single to Posey and is relieved by Derek Holland, who walks three straight batters. That is pretty similar to how his future White Sox tenure would be, so I don't really have any sympathy for him there. Then you have him coming out. Coming in for him is Mark Lowe. He walks a World Series record fourth straight batter. Then gives up a two RBI single to Renteria. So he comes out of the game. Michael Kirkman is in. He promptly gives up a two RBI triple to Aaron Rowand and RBI double to Torres. In all, the Giants send 11 men to the plate in that inning. They score 7 runs on 4 hits. That is the most runs for the franchise at World Series inning since the 7th inning of Game 3 of the 1921 series. The Giants' 20 runs through the first two games tie a World Series record. So even though Matt Kane is brilliant on the mound, and that brings his total number of innings since 2006 to 1,493 and a third, the eighth most in baseball, everybody's talking about that offense at the end of this one as the Giants leave San Francisco up 2-0 after a 9-0 win.
Yeah, I mean, not a whole lot more you can say here of the Giants' bats, and eyes to some extent mentioning the four straight walks that they drew in the bottom half of the eighth to break this game wide open, kind of really helping set the tone, and the Giants have done exactly what they've needed to do so far, take care of business when both at home. And so we head to Texas. This is just the second World Series to take place in the state and the first World Series to take place in the northern part of Texas.
By the way, that shutout in Game 2 is the most lopsided of the World Series since the Royals embarrassed the Cardinals to end the 1985 series, although the Cardinals didn't do themselves any favors by melting down mentally because of what happened in Game 6. But we are getting way off topic here. If you want to hear more about that, go back and listen to our 1985 episode. Nolan Ryan throws out the first pitch before Game 3, and perhaps inspired by Ryan, Nelson Cruz doubles to lead off the second inning. Molina walks with two outs, and both score. Rookie Mitch Moreland hits a 3-run homer to right field. And then with two outs in the fifth inning, Josh Hamilton, who hit 23 home runs in 75 home games between the regular season and the playoffs before this World Series, hits a solo home run to right center. Then Ross hits a solo home run to left center with one out in the seventh to get the Giants on the board. And then Torres hits a solo home run to right with one out in the eighth inning. And then after Huff is hit by a pitch with two outs, Darren O'Day relieves Colby Lewis. Lewis had struck out 6 on 103 pitches. The only run surrender were those two solo home runs. Posey promptly grounds out to short on a full count. Feliz pitches a perfect ninth for the save. That is his first save of the playoffs. He becomes the youngest American League pitcher to record a series save at 22 years, 181 days. 4-2, the final score. The Rangers are on the board in this series.
Yeah, no, a nice job by the Rangers coming back home, getting inspired. Interesting to have a game that is entirely home run based in terms of offense, but the Rangers have to be feeling a little bit better here. They managed to get on the board. They are still at home, have an opportunity here now to tie the series in a pivotal game 4.
And game 4 will feature Madison Bumgarner. As we mentioned earlier, he started the season in AAA. He becomes the fifth youngest pitcher to start a World Series game. And Bumgarner and Posey are the first rookie starting battery in the World Series since Speck Shea and Yogi Berra did for the Yankees in Game 1 of the 1947 series. Perhaps an attempt to shake up the lineup, Bruce Bochy benches Pat Burrell for this game. Bumgarner walks Andrews to lead off the first, but he induces a fielder's choice by Young and a 4-6-3 double play by Hamilton. Hamilton, though, makes up for that with his glove, makes a diving catch on a Sheerholtz line drive to center for the final out of the second. And then Torres doubles off first base to lead off the third inning. He later scores on a two-run homer to right field by Huff, who coincidentally grew up as a Rangers fan, so that was obviously a cool moment for him. Young singles to lead off the fourth inning. He is forced out on a Hamilton line drive to second. Guerrero strikes out swinging, and Hamilton is caught stealing second to end the inning. Renteria singles with one out to the seventh. That is his third hit of the game. He later scores on a Torres RBI double. Darren O'Day relieves Darren Oliver with one out in the eighth inning. He promptly gives up a Posey solo homer to center. Posey, at 23 years and 218 days, is the youngest catcher to homer in a World Series game since Johnny Bench in Game 2 of the 1970s series. And he received that ball from the fans who got the ball after the game. So credit to them for that, knowing that they knew the significance of that moment. Bumgarner throws 8 shutout innings, gives up 3 hits, walks 2, strikes out 6. Wilson pitches a perfect 9th. The Giants win this game 4-0. The Giants become the first team with multiple shutouts in the World Series since the Orioles had 3 in 1966, and Bumgarner becomes the 4th youngest series starter to win a game. The only pitchers who were younger were Fernando Valenzuela of the 1981 Dodgers, Jim Palmer of those 1966 Orioles, and then you have to go back to the 1913 Philadelphia Athletics with both Joe Bush.
Quite a list there of kind of going back to a lot of names that we talked about a long time ago. And the Giants now with a stranglehold here on this series, and they're going back to Tim Lincecum in Game 5, so they have to be feeling confident about this not having to go back to San Francisco.
Yeah, they want to get this done as soon as possible, even though they're going to get a couple more chances if they lose this. The Game 1 starters, Lincecum and Lee, take the mound, and this time we get the pitcher's duel that we were promised in Game 1. They allow 3 hits through 5 innings, no runs through 6 innings. We do get a little bit of offense in the 6th inning. Sanchez singles with 2 outs, and Posey has a deep fly out to right to end the inning. On another night, that ball might have left the yard. Lincecum needs only 7 pitches to get through the 6th inning with no damage. And then to lead off the 7th inning, Ross and Uribe have back-to-back singles. Huff advances the runners on the only sack bunt of his career, both regular season and playoffs. Pat Burrell strikes out. And then Edgar Renteria makes good on a promise he made before the game. Because as we find out on the World Series film, narrated this time by San Francisco native Rob Schneider, Renteria told Torres before the game that he would hit a home run. Renteria is no stranger to World Series heroics. He is older now, but way back in 1997, he had the walk-off hit to clinch the series for the Marlins that spawned the iconic shot of Craig Counsell leaping high in the air as he is scoring the winning run, with Bob Costas saying, "The Florida Marlins have won the World Series and the men in teal are for real." Costas is nowhere to be found, unfortunately, because NBC has not had the World Series since 1999. And as of this recording, has not had it and will not have it for the foreseeable future, I'm sorry to say. But in any event, Renteria makes good on that promise. He hits a 3-run homer to left center. And probably the coolest part about this is as soon as he crosses the plate, he basically screams, "I told you, I told you."
We've talked about instances of calling your shot. You know, you think back to Babe Ruth against the Cubs back in the 30s. And, you know, this one obviously a little less fanfare because it was more of a behind closed doors initially of, "I'm going to hit a home run here." But the Mike's being able to catch the, you know, "I told you I was going to do it" is pretty cool.
Probably the only other thing I can compare this to, at least off the top of my head, was Chili Davis and Curry Puckett talking before Puckett's iconic at bat in Game 6 of the 1991 World Series, where Puckett was basically told, "Just hit a home run, don't bother trying to get on base," and that gave birth to the iconic "And we'll see you tomorrow night" call from Jack Buck. Cruz hits a solo home run to left with one out in the 7th, so the Rangers aren't going away just yet. Kinsler walks, but then David Murphy and Benji Molina strike out to end the inning. Tim Lincecum throws a perfect eighth to cap a night in which he struck out 10, walked 2, and gave up 3 hits. Lincecum, we mentioned earlier how he had a bad August, but after September 1st, including the playoffs, he will go 10-2 with a 2.18 ERA that includes 4 playoff wins in 6 games, and he also ran his season innings total to 249 and a third innings, a career high. Lincecum might not win the Cy Young Award this year because that bad stretch in August probably cost him any real shot at it. But he shined when it most mattered. And we'll talk more about the rest of the rotation in a little bit. But Lincecum was the ace of the staff and he lived up to his reputation. Maybe not so much in Game 1, but in Game 5, definitely.
And just to kind of go paint a whole overall picture here, now you have the asterisk of multiple playoff series now at this point, but spoiler alert, this will be Tim Lincecum's 4th win of the postseason. That sets a Giants franchise record, breaking the tie that he had held with, just some random guy by the name of Christy Mathewson.
Meanwhile, as the top of the 9th is being played in a city in Illinois known as Naperville, a 21-year-old college student is doing his DJ shift. And this young man might sound familiar to you, so I'm just going to play what he said as this top of the 9th was being played.
A reminder before I get back into the music, or maybe it's just an update. It's the top of the 9th. The Giants are up on the Rangers 3-1. So before we have our sports report at 9:55, the World Series and the 2010 baseball season could be over. So stay tuned. And if you're a baseball fan, listen to the end of the World Series if that is what we're going to see tonight. But actually just watch it. But have our station on in the background, please. Okay, thanks. Let's get back to the music now with the request for the Clarks. Hey You, right here on your home for the classics to the cutting edge, FM 89 WONC. Hope you're having a good night out there.
You sounded so young.
I do sound really young. I was able to watch this on an old standard definition TV, color white. So for the first and only time as a college radio DJ, I am working my shift as a World Series is coming to an end, which it does when Brian Wilson pitches a perfect 9th inning. Lincecum becomes the first Giants pitcher to win 2 series games since Carl Hubbell in 1933. The Giants are the first team to home run every World Series game since the 1995 Braves, but more importantly, the Giants have won their first World Series in San Francisco. Let's just go back to 21-year-old me and hear what I said in the mere moments after this World Series ended.
Before I get back to the music, let it be known that the 3rd longest World Series drought in Major League Baseball is no more, as the Giants have won the World Series for the first time since they were the New York Giants back in 1954. And for us White Sox fans, that means we get to see Juan Uribe and Aaron Rowan celebrate their 2nd world championship.
And yes, as I mentioned, this brings an end to the then 3rd longest World Series title drought, because in recent years, World Series wins by the Red Sox and White Sox bumps the Giants up to 3rd on the World Series title drought list. But now that is no more. And unfortunately for one of our favorite professors, Dr. Stephen Maynard Caliendo, the Pirates are now up to 3rd on the list. At least as far as teams that have won a World Series championship, there are still a couple of teams that have not won a World Series longer. But as far as actual World Series title droughts, the Pirates are 3rd now. But in any event, this is another team of castoffs of late that has come together and won the whole thing. And in addition to me being happy for my buddies Juan and Aaron, how could anyone not really be happy for this franchise?
You know, you look back to instances here with Boston fans in 04 and, you know, yourself and your fellow White Sox fans in 2005 and even to a degree Phillies fans in 2008. And you know, here again, you have a long-suffering fan base that has not seen this team that came to them over a half century prior finally manage to climb the mountaintop, and they do it not like the prior year with a bunch of guys that were bought, but with a lot of homegrown and signing cast-offs that everybody just happens to gel, and the team gets hot at the right time. And here they are, they're World Series champions. And my favorite moment, I think, from all of this was, and unfortunately this wasn't caught in the World Series film because it really is my favorite thing, is the post-game interview with Giants closer Brian Wilson, who, I mean, there really is nothing more you could say other than what he does of just, you know, turning and staring straight at the camera going, "I feel like I want to rage right now. Brian Wilson is my spirit animal."
He was Travis Kelce before Travis Kelce.
That's a good comparison.
The Giants pitching staff is finishing the season on an incredible hot streak. After August 29th, they combine to go 22-8 with a 2.02 ERA. The Giants go 31-10 during those particular starts. They win 76% of the time. Only two teams besides these Giants have ever thrown four playoff shutouts. The 1998 Yankees, who won 125 games, and the 1905 Giants, the first Giants to win. And, of course, it was then when Christy Mathews and Joe McGinnity won all four World Series games with shutouts. And here we are 105 years later, we have a similarly dominant pitching staff. And everybody is just so happy that these guys will be around for a while. And yet, in spite of that, it is not any of them who win World Series MVP. It is the man who provided the power heroics in Game 5 and had a pretty good series, Edgar Renteria, which is why it breaks my heart that only a few days after this, he is no longer a Giant because he is granted free agency. And talk about the highest of highs and the lowest of lows in 1 week. 1 minute you have a job and you're winning World Series MVP, and then the next day you're celebrating and you have a parade. And the next thing you know, it's see ya, buddy.
Yeah, I mean, that just kind of shows how rough the reality of baseball as a business really is. Renteria, for his part in this series, slashes .412, .444, .765 for a .1209 OPS, has two home runs, including the eventual game winner here in Game 5, drives in a team-high 6 for the series, goes 7-17, scores also a team-high 6 runs. I feel like you could have potentially made the argument for Tim Lincecum were it not for the fact that he struggled a little bit in Game 1. He finishes the series, though, 2-0 with a 3.29 ERA, allows 5 earned runs over 13 2/3 innings, strikes out 13 in that stretch of time. So, I mean, he was lights out, especially here in this Game 5 clincher, but I think the struggles in Game 1 kind of taking those votes away from him, and it has to go ultimately to the guy who delivers the series-winning hit. So, not really much of an argument for me.
And the Rangers don't really do a lot to help their own cause, particularly that part of the order that included Cruz, Hamilton, and Guerrero. And we barely even talked about Guerrero during this episode, so it just goes to show you how little of an impact he had. Those three combined to go 7-54, a .130 batting average. And while the Giants are scoring 29 runs in this 5-game series, the Rangers have 29 hits. But when you are facing a Giants rotation that doesn't lose 2 games in a row during the entire playoffs, and the Stars' ERA in 4 games after a loss is 1.11, I don't think you have a chance anyway.
You really don't. I think it kind of gets down to what I would say a lot of people consider one of the main truths about baseball, and that is that pitching is king. And we really see it here, and it's kind of crazy to think about with some of the other rotations that we see get built, like this, that Philadelphia Phillies rotation that we talked about, this team that the Giants beat in the NLCS. Yes, they lost Cliff Lee, but then they went and added Roy Halladay, who threw a no-hitter in the NLDS, and they're not able to string together anything after that 2008 title. You know, you look at several other teams that built all of this success, and it's not always going to work. But at least for now, you have the Giants with a championship, and the future is bright in San Francisco.
Absolutely. Let me just recap what these Giants pitchers did during this entire postseason. Lincecum wins 4 of his 5 starts. Bumgarner is 2-0 with a 2.18 ERA over 4 games. And Kane, obviously, was the best as he threw 21 1/3 shutout innings. And this is in a postseason that had 4 Cy Young Award winners, We mentioned Lincecum. We mentioned Lee. We mentioned Halliday. CeCe Sabathia is the other one. And the Rangers had to battle the Yankees to get to the World Series, only to find out that they really had multiple Sabathias facing them. And these are names that will live in Giants lore forever. And the crazy part is, we're not done seeing a lot of these guys yet.
Yeah, spoiler alert, but these are a bunch of folks that will pop up again, though it will not happen next week as we look ahead, and we are going to get an absolute classic coming up.
We are. And before I forget, let me just go back to the past real quickly. Let's hear what our mutual friend Ryan Pierce read off of the AP Wire as I was producing his sportscast that night.
The San Francisco Giants are world champions for the first time since 1954, when the franchise was known as the New York Giants. Edgar Renteria's three-run home run and Tim Lincecum's stellar pitching gave the Giants a title after San Fran closed out Texas 3-1 to win the series in five games. Lincecum shut down the Giants on three hits, striking out 10 in his eight innings. The only Texas run came on a home run by Nelson Cruz in the seventh.
And on that, we can officially close the book on this 2010 World Series. Let's look ahead to 2011. The Giants will not be back, but the Rangers will be. And they will be facing a team that has won a World Series of late, much to your chagrin, Lucas. But while this series will go the distance, it is remembered for one game and one game only. Strangely, not the clincher. And we have had some episodes like this. But this one will put all other such instances to shame, save for maybe a very select few.
Yeah, spoiler alert for next week. Beware the little guy. Tune in next week to find out who.
So for Lucas Mitzel, I'm Jeffrey Clark. Thanks for listening to our 2010 episode of Then There Were Two, a History of the World Series. If you like us on Facebook, follow us on what will still be Twitter to us now and forever. Subscribe. We will see you next time.